This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is Afternoons on Dubai Eye 103.8.
I'm Helen Farmer. Fantastic to have you with us on the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. Today, children's health, parenting, education and more. Talking about a good night's sleep. Are you getting it? And if not, is it because of your kids? Julie Mallon, sleep consultant, was on hand as we talked about a new technique out of Japan for soothing newborns and how much sleep does a teenager actually need? We were discussing the removal of masks and the anxiety it might be causing your child, both a doctor and a psychologist explaining about how to deal with that change and when we should actually be wearing one. Discussing a new platform for work experience for kids, getting them into the workforce. And with social media going nowhere, good or bad, love it or hate it, what are some of the tools in place for families to make sure their children and teens are safe online? Plus, sustainability in schools. Dubai Can on hand to explain what's been happening behind the scenes.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Oh, how did you sleep last night? And if it wasn't well, was it because of a small person in your life? We are bringing in the experts because it sounds like an awful lot of people, whether it is struggling to get back into routine with school or increased stress and anxiety, are tots, teens, babies, well, helping you get through the night with Julie Mallon. She's a sleep consultant at Nurture to Sleep. Julie, you're incredibly busy all the time. I always really value your time of coming in. But what is keeping you busy? What are some of the, I guess, common concerns and issues that families are coming to you with?
This week in particular, it's really interesting that we've had older children. So I had a real SOS call from New York. Their five-year-old had slept every single night since she was a tiny, tiny baby. And suddenly is sleeping no longer and the parents are broken. I've had three calls this week, again, with 7 and 5 year olds. So it's really interesting what's going on at the minute.
Okay. Well, we can take questions, as I said, all the way from the newborns up to teens. And I think teens and sleep is a really interesting one. And can I ask you a question before we go to the text line?
Yes.
So my daughters have quite different sleep patterns, but the older one at the minute is 7 and a half. And she's saying she's not tired. So she goes down to bed about 7:30. She might read for a little bit. And 10 minutes later, she appears in the doorway. I can't sleep. I'm not tired. And then she starts getting herself worked up. She gets anxious. I just can't sleep, mummy. And I'm like, well, you've got to give your body a chance to sleep. And the more worked up she gets, of course, then, you know, the less likely. Yeah. So what can we do about kids that are saying they're not tired when she clearly is tired? She's very active. She's up most mornings at 5:30, 6 o'clock. She needs the sleep. She's just not there.
And that's part of the problem, that she is getting up so early. She's actually overtired. Mm-hmm. But then the other thing is we have to be really in control of what's happening to us, and then we can transfer that. So it's like, you know, she's gone up to bed. You know, all of us as parents, I remember that too. We let our shoulders down. Oh, okay.
It's our time now. Yeah.
And then suddenly it's like, no, I've got too much to do. And actually that's really not helping, because we need to have our own script and we need to have made a plan as to what will happen. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, nobody, no parent, when their child comes, will say, okay, so, oh, okay, let's, it's like, no, I have so much to do. This is just the worst thing ever.
Yeah, I've been hanging on all day to have a couple of hours to myself.
Yeah.
And here you are. And that's the thing, I don't want to be angry at her for this, because I don't want this to get those kind of associations. So for anyone else who's having this, I'm not tired, I don't want to go to bed, even though, like, you are tired and you are going to bed, what can we as parents be putting into place to help with that, Julie?
Again, one of the first things we do, that you practice earlier on. So you practice so it doesn't become that crisis management situation. You practice earlier on in the day. You look at strategies such as you doing the self-talk and practicing. You can also personify the worry if she is, really personifying whatever it is that is stopping her from sleeping is so powerful. You know, giving it a name. You're not tired, so it's the tired monster is not letting you sleep. And then, okay, so what can we do here?
Introducing the idea of monsters at bedtime.
Okay, so not tired monsters, but one of her superheroes. Mm-hmm. You know, give that a name, one of her superheroes, and then attach that so you're personifying it. But giving her those strategies, and of course, meditation really, really works, but not without practice.
Okay.
You know, there's something really powerful, which is a meditation intervention where she takes her index finger and her thumb and she rubs them together. And that's just really helping her come back into the present.
Mm-hmm.
So something like that, it has to be concrete.
Okay. I might WhatsApp you about 8 o'clock tonight. Hi, Julie. We're trying this. Okay, right. Enough about me, but hopefully I just wanted to kind of share with anyone who's listening that you're certainly not alone. And you think you get past the newborn stage and it's just a different set of problems.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Live in the studio, Julie Mallon, sleep consultant at Nurture to Sleep, taking my questions and yours, more importantly. Before we go to the text line, Julie, in the news just over the last week was claiming to be a cure-all baby soothing technique, a sleep walk 5-minute fixer. What's it all about and what do you think of it?
I think the first thing to say is to look, really look at the study. There was 21 parents, 21 mothers, so there was no fathers, which I think is, we want our fathers. The more and more evidence is we want our fathers to come on board, and we know that when they come on board, our children do sleep better. So I think that's what I wasn't comfortable with. It was just mothers and 21 babies. It also didn't give the age of the babies. It was infant, so I'm presuming it's up until the age of 3 months. So a 3-month-old baby is very different from a 5-month-old baby or an 8-month-old baby. And I just feel that our parents have got, you know, as a new mom, as a new dad, you have so much pressure and you're so exhausted. And you go to that and it has said, this is absolutely going to work. The evidence is, you know, one of the researchers, the lead researcher had 4 children of her own. And she said, I was really surprised that it did actually work. But we're not giving the full picture. So the first thing I want to say, you know your baby better than anyone. And regardless of what the research says, and of course we need to trust research and use it to help us. But I also feel that parenting is intuitive. Now, with this research, what it was saying was that, yes, you walk for 5 minutes and then you sit and hold your baby for 8 minutes. It was very precise. And then you place your baby into the cot. And then your baby is going to sleep. And the evidence was saying...
It sounds too good to be true.
I know. And I think, you know, we really don't have enough of the backstory of those 21 parents and those 21 babies. Mm. So I just think to view the research as an option. Try it. And if it works for you, wonderful.
Great. But, yeah. But you haven't failed if it doesn't.
That's
your baby is not broken if they're not being fixed by a new study out of Japan. Okay. Let's go to the text line. Interesting question from Azza on 4001 saying, do some kids just need less sleep than others? Our girls are totally different in terms of their sleep requirements.
We all have our own sleep need. So that's the first thing to recognise. Just like, you know, we have tall people, we have small people. And it's about meeting that sleep need. But the averages are there. And when we see that our children achieve those averages, they are, you know, they function so much better on every aspect of their being. Mm-hmm. So, yes, they may be on the low sleep need or the high sleep need, but it's not that far off the average.
It'll be within a range.
Yes.
Okay. No name on this message, and it's absolutely fine to be anonymous if you prefer. No name saying, my 10-week-old son is loving using my breast for comfort. Once he is asleep, I try to put him down, but he wakes up instantly. Can you recommend any dummies so we can hopefully, he won't wake up and I can settle him easily?
The first thing to recognise is that's exactly why he's waking up. So, you know, it's the equivalent of if we were to fall, when we go to bed at night and we go into our bed, we don't expect to wake up, unless we're a student, of course, maybe, but we don't expect to wake up.
On a roundabout.
Yeah, on a roundabout. And when we do that, that's really triggering our children to wake up. Also, what's very, very interesting with some research, what they've found is that when we are holding our baby, there is a sensor in a newborn's tummy, which is connected to the mummy's tummy. So when you put that baby down into the cot and it's a long way down, that's what triggers the baby to wake up. It's not actually going on their back.
Oh, interesting. It's a proximity thing as well.
Yeah, it is.
So where do you stand on dummies to help kind of ease the transition, such as the one that we've had a message about?
The first thing is to take... We always move in baby steps. So first of all, you want to take the baby off the breast and hold the baby and then place the baby down. So that's about doing those very gradual steps. The second, in answer to your question about the pacifiers, if your pacifier is working for your baby and it's not disrupting a child's sleep, then it's absolutely fine to use it. And it's just about what your baby likes. Mm-hmm. So I would try two different types, and just keep to those two. Don't keep going and chopping and changing, because that's not what's going to help the baby. And the other thing here is, we know that up until a child is 8 months old, they don't have what we call object permanence. And so to get you through these really challenging first couple of months, you know, up until 6 months, and then you've got this window between 6 and 8 months, because their memory is not as sharp, that's when you can remove it if you wish to.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting you say that, because my two girls, the older one loved a dummy, loved it, had to do a whole kind of dummy fairy extraction process when she was 3 years old. The second one didn't give a monkeys, and it would have been quite useful had she taken it in retrospect. I'm certainly not calling pacifiers gadgets, but I wondered if there were any kind of sleep aids or bits of kit that you found to be useful with families you work with, or anything that you think has got some really good data behind it to help easing into sleep, staying asleep, or just good sleep hygiene, which seems ironic for a gadget, but you know what I'm getting at.
Yes, it's about what your child is connected to. It's all about connection. And there's something called the Tony Box. And I've seen this, and I've seen children really, really love it.
It's a storytelling, is it?
It is a storytelling, but it's particularly relevant where there's lots of expats here and where the grandparents are in different countries. So there's a character which sits on this box, and then the character reads the story, which is, you know, maybe grandpa or grandma or aunties and uncles. It's them reading the story.
It's their voice.
It's their voice. It's really, really lovely.
Oh, this just gave me goosebumps thinking about that.
I know. But the other thing that's really wonderful is the child has autonomy. So the child makes the choices of who they'd like to read their story tonight. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so it's very funny. Sometimes I can hear, do you want to hear Granddad tonight? And it's like, no, I want to hear Auntie. It's like, oh, okay then.
Tony Box. It's TONIE, I believe. Okay, I'm going to have a little check it out.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It is your sleep clinic here on Dubai i103.8. Julie Mallon, sleep consultant at Nurture to Sleep, is joining us live to answer your questions. Julie, how do you feel about a quick fire round?
I'm ready.
See how many people we can help in the next 10 minutes or so. We've had a message here from Camilla. Who's saying, my 17-year-old son stays up late, sometimes past midnight, and as a result has 2 or 3 energy drinks per day. I know we need to sort this, but where to start?
Him being on board, you have to get him to buy in. But also recognising that teenage sleep is very, very different. You know, the melatonin comes in as late as 1 o'clock in the morning. So he isn't actually ready to sleep, but of course other things such as the energy drinks. But you have to get him on board. And then once you do, you both work out a plan together. That's the first thing, and that's what's going to really make the difference.
Get a 17-year-old on board to stop playing games until after midnight. Camilla, good luck. I think it's a really challenging one, because I think there's an element of addiction there. We actually are going to be addressing gaming addiction on the show with recovery coach David Golding in a couple of weeks. So if this is something that is affecting you, and when I say, I mean a true addiction, please don't hesitate to get in touch and we can connect you with David. But I think that buy-in, this is the thing, you can't be helped unless you want the help. Now, no name on this message, saying, we've got a wedding coming up, we're going to be taking our 10-month-old son to. He's got a pretty solid bedtime, sleeps well in his cot, has never napped longer than 30 minutes anywhere else. We're going to be at the wedding until midnight if all goes to plan, and don't have the option of going back to the hotel early. I've got no idea what impact this is going to have on his sleep. Does one night of disruption make a big difference?
It's not the night that you want to focus on. It's his actual daytime sleep. So yes, he's solidly sleeping, but actually that may be due to the fact that he's not sleeping well during the day.
Okay.
You know, at 10 months, we still want our babies to be having a daytime sleep of 3 hours approximately. His sleep cycle up until he's 3 years of age is 1 hour. So if he's only doing 30-minute nap, he's actually missing out on a really important part of the rest of his sleep. So we need to focus more on the naps rather than his night sleep. The second thing is, before you go on that wedding, make sure he's as rested as he can be, and then he can cope with that variable. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing to do is, if you're going to bring a travel cot, That's going to be really helpful. You don't need to go back to the hotel, but he can sleep in the travel cot. And again, he'll need some practice before you do it. So 3 or 4 days before you go to the wedding, he sees the travel cot. You then put his bottom sheet from his bed, so it smells familiar. You put that onto the travel cot, and then he spends a couple of nights sleeping in it. And that's going to help make that transition so much smoother. So one night doesn't make a difference as long as you plan ahead.
Makes a lot of sense. A message here, and this is from Gillian, saying, does it matter what position our kids sleep in? That's such an interesting question. Does it make a difference?
No, it doesn't make a difference. Just think about how we sleep at night. Nobody could put us into our position for sleep. Mm-hmm. You know, often I see parents moving their baby back into the middle of the cot, or when actually what they're baby is doing is meeting their need. So very often a baby will feel the cot go right down to the bottom, and that is because that sensory need is being met. Mm-hmm. Now, safety obviously always an issue, so you want to make sure that if you've got a duvet that it's not going up over their head, and depending on their age, but no.
Julie, we've been talking earlier about the headlines, the Japanese sleep technique, but also something that caught my eye recently is about co-sleeping. And you can define co-sleeping in many different ways, but this is specific to really little ones. And unfortunately, I mean, tragically, back in 2020, over 900 babies died in America. This is due to accidental suffocation and strangulation in bed. This is according to the CDC. And I just wondered what kind of guidelines people need to have in place when it comes to co-sleeping with infants in particular to do this safely, because it is such a personal choice. And I think parents and babies can get an awful lot out of it, but it needs to be done safely. And
there is so much information out there that it is actually overwhelming. But you need to go to, like, for example, back in the UK, we have the Lullaby Trust. So access that website, and it is really, really clear, precise information, which they've set it up in such a way that your very tired parent can really consume that information very, very easily. This study that you were talking about, one of it was initiated, lots of research coming out of Australia, and co-sleeping, they are now saying, with the Academy of Pediatrics in America, for example, they will not endorse co-sleeping. Now, that's not going to help if that's your only way that you're going to go to sleep. Mm-hmm. But there's lots of things like if you have a cold, if your baby has a cold, if you're underweight, if your baby's underweight, you would not co-sleep. And it's all, so much of it is about temperature, that your baby overheats. Your baby then starts to forget to breathe, and then we have these accidents. But equally, it is that we smother our baby, which it's something you want to avoid. So you can have these side cots where your baby is right beside you, and you still have access without the co-sleeping. If you are absolutely exhausted, you know that's an alert call, an alarm call for you to know that you wouldn't hear your baby.
Mm-hmm. Please do remind us of that website.
The Lullaby Trust.
Okay, hope that
And then,
helps.
Sorry, one more thing. We were talking about pacifiers before. There's lots of research out there as well that supports the use of a pacifier up until 6 months. And babies who have the pacifier up until 6 months, there's a reduced incidence of sudden infant cot death.
Lots of data out there, but please make sure you're going to tried and trusted websites and resources. Discussing older children, the message here saying very physically active mid-teen, doing sports most days, sleep has always been bad. But since COVID, she typically gets 4 or 5 hours of sleep per night. If we take away electronics, she grabs a book or gets up and watches TV, hence she'll fall asleep in the car. Concentration at school is a problem. It's not a lot of sleep, poor thing.
No, not a lot of sleep at all. But again, it's getting her on board. She's at an age where you really can work with her. You can show her the evidence about not getting sleep. You can show her the evidence about how better sleep means that she's going to get better grades if that's what she's wanting. Better sleep is going, all these things are going to happen if she gets better sleep. But you've got to, again, get her on board. Now, the other thing is looking at lifestyle changes. There's no point in you saying, you know, that the electronics have got to come off at this time. We've actually got to help both of you come to an agreement of why it's going to happen. Mm-hmm. You also want to be looking at the weekend, so she's not having too much sleep at the weekend, because what happens here, we cause social jet lag. So if she's sleeping in later in the week, what happens then over the weekend, if she's sleeping in later, it will take her till about Tuesday to get her internal body clock back to being prepared for waking, ready for the morning?
In terms of sleep requirements, you know, as we said, this kind of a changes from newborns all the way through to adulthood. For a mid-teen, so let's say 14, 15, how many hours a night would be advised, ideally?
Ideally 9 hours, because their body is going through so many changes. If you think of how the brain is changing, if you think of their physical changes, mm-hmm. and then if you think of all the stresses that they have, social media, you know, all the issues with their friends, so all that emotional change. So they do need, on average, the Sleep Foundation are recommending 9 hours.
Okay, let's see if we can help out one exhausted parent before we let it get back to your many exhausted parents you helped, Julie. So my 7-year-old son has been waking up nearly every night since being a baby. I've taken him to different sleep advisors, but he continues, he'll come and I'll take him back with no fuss. And some nights he'll go straight back, and others he'll be back in our room 5 or 10 minutes later and I do it again. But as you can imagine, it's exhausting. To crying emojis, please advise. This is the thing. This is how stressful sleep can be, how emotional sleep can be. And what would, I mean, I know it's very hard just from one message, but are there any tips that immediately come to mind for helping this family?
Take ownership of those feelings that you are having going in that 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning, first thing, so that you can then be the leader. Our children are very good at wanting to be the leader, especially at 3 o'clock in the morning.
When we're feeling our defences are down and our will. I think you're doing amazing for getting up at that time and taking him back consistently, because I think I probably would be like, do you know what? Sleep's more important right now for me.
Yeah. But again, you take it right back to the very beginning. So you would bring them in. You could get a mattress beside your bed and that's where you would start. And then gradually you take them out of your room. You also could do something like having a weighted blanket, because it could be that he has a sensory need that is not being met. Mm-hmm. So look at using things like the weighted blanket. We also need to look at magnesium. We also need to look to see if his hemoglobin is low. If he has a low hemoglobin, then it's very possible that's one of the reasons for sleeping. It needs to be looked at, I think, in a little bit further detail.
I will send you Julie's details, mystery listener. But truly, sending strength, patience, I'm thinking of you tonight. Julie, for anyone that does want your details right here, right now, what's the best way of getting in touch?
Probably on our Instagram page, which is Nurture to Sleep.
That's the number two. Julie, thank you so, so much. Have an amazing trip. I know you're off to Ireland for a bit of work and a bit of holiday. But when you get back, we'd love to have another catch up. And as I said, it's been a busy show. We haven't got to all the messages. So if you'd come back, I'd be delighted.
Thank you. I love it.
Well, it's been a pleasure. And as I said, we will connect anyone who wants to get in touch with Julie. 4001. Send me a quick message and I will send her details over.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It has, of course, been a big week in the world of news, world of headlines, and the world of health as well. As of yesterday, masks are no longer compulsory in the UAE. Of course, some worthy exceptions, medical facilities, places of worship, public transport as well. But with a real spotlight on the kids today, I'm curious to get your take. How are your children, your teens, feeling about this change? We are going to be joined by a child psychologist shortly. And to discuss the health side now is specialist paediatrician, medical director and owner of Circle Care Clinic, Dr. Rania, who has been very much the voice of reason during the last couple of years when it comes to deciphering some of the COVID data. Please do send in any questions or indeed any concerns that you might have. We've already had a number coming through on the text line and also the phone line too.
Hi, I'm a mom of 2 teenagers and they would love to take off their masks and have been really strict about wearing them. But the thing they need to know is the science behind it. Was this a rational decision based on looking at numbers, on assessing the risk, or was this decision to say, you know, look, people are going to get COVID, life must go on, because they don't want to be sick. It's very disruptive. And so in some ways, part of the problem is that people are also not testing. People are coming to school sick already. And so if only you could say, you know, no masks, but if you have symptoms, to mask, something to mitigate the spread, because it's extremely disruptive. Mm-hmm. So the anxiety is based on that, on what are the facts.
I think that's such an interesting point in terms of wanting to know a little bit more about these decisions and ultimately keeping ourselves safe. Dr. Rania, tell us a little bit about your reaction to the news earlier this week.
It's about time. It's time. Basically, I was the one saying masks, masks, masks from the very beginning, because to be honest, I think the mask was probably our biggest protective tool. But I think most of us were away over the summer and lived our lives very normally without a mask. Mm-hmm. And now that the children are back at school and we've all been in the shopping malls, we've all been in the restaurants, and it felt like children were sort of the last man standing in masks. And I think they did it very well here in the UAE. School started, they observed and monitored for the first month and realized that COVID cases did not spike the way they did in May and June. Which is when there was going to be a review of the mask wearing, we were led to believe. And then, of course, the mask stayed because of what happened then. Mm-hmm. And cases did not spike. What we did see is what we have to say now is a return to normal. The clinic feels normal.
Does it really? I was going to ask you, what's coming into clinic at the minute? I've heard about some pretty nasty flu that's going around. Are you seeing much of that?
Yes. So it's influenza. We're back to the viruses we expect to see as we get closer to the winter months. We're back to the viruses we expect to see at the beginning of the school year. And yes, we are disadvantaged in a way because we went through a whole year of not having these viruses or not being exposed to them. So that does affect our immunity to some degree, or a couple of years of not being as exposed to them. But we're back to seeing the regular viruses, whereas almost like with COVID, more contagious than the others, and all the protective measures we were taking, these viruses weren't allowed to propagate as they should. So I understand people's anxiety. I heard the lady who you spoke to just before I came on, that people's anxiety about viruses mitigating COVID. I think we all agree, anyone who's had it in the last few months agrees, seems less severe for the majority of people, especially children, than all the other viruses around in terms of the symptoms.
And I think that point about really just being sensible, you know, if you're feeling unwell or you're looking to protect vulnerable people in your home and suspect you're going to be around people who might be carrying some undesirable germs, then mask up, take extra precautions. And I think that probably is going to be the new normal. It's the polite thing to do. We, you know, entering into a bit of a social contract now about we've got these bits of kit at our disposal and it's just going to be woven into our lives. Dr. Rania, I just wanted to ask you, apart from COVID, you know, what else can be prevented by wearing masks? When should we be considering them?
So any respiratory virus that spreads by droplet spread, by coughing, by sneezing, can be prevented, or at least the spread of it can be reduced by wearing a mask. So influenza is another one, or any other virus. I mean, RSV is another one, although that affects the younger kids mainly, so you really wouldn't see them in masks. To be honest, any virus that causes a horrible cold, because that is what the mask is doing, is trying to create that barrier between the mouth and nose and the rest of the world.
Thanks, Dr. Rania. Really do appreciate it. Dr. Rania there speaking to us from Circle Care Clinic, where she's a specialist paediatrician. Do urge you check her out on social media, because some great kind of accessible information about what's happening in the medical world.
Family Matters
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
So the recent announcement, UA no longer requiring masks, has been met, unsurprisingly, by mixed feelings. Some people delighted, whipping them off. Others feeling less sure, and some anxiety there, which, when we think about the last couple of years, is no surprise. There's been an awful lot of uncertainty. And now what feels like, for some, a very welcome change, and for others, just a big change. So to help us unpick this and also how to talk to our children about it, Dr. Ola is with us, a psychologist and play and art therapist. She got her PhD in counselling from Newcastle University and is also a certified CBT child and adult therapist. Thank you so much for joining us. Masks have very much been the norm. I came out of, I was in the lift actually just this morning, and I was like, I felt really naughty to not be wearing, you know. but they have been the norm for the last 2.5 years. When we look at children in particular, this is a huge amount of time in a child's life. So how can we kind of break down this seemingly sudden, to their minds, change in the rules?
Yes, you know, I want to say that that conversation started 2.5 years ago with our children. So it's not a sudden conversation that we need to begin from the scratch. Because you know how it all started, how we all felt. Then there was a lot of strategies and advice how to help children to stay at home, do their homework at home, wear a mask when they go out, and so on. So it's a continuation, right, of that conversation. And at the moment, it's pretty much the same steps that we follow, which is manage ourselves first, because I know we're talking about children's anxiety, but in my experience, I see a lot of adults who also feel anxious about no mask.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
So what's important here again is to see how we feel and what it is that our children overhear, what do we share with others, mm-hmm. what are our own fears and how it affects them, and then just start really unpacking it from the logical perspective. Yeah, so why is it happening now? Is it safe enough? And, you know, it's not an immediate decision. So there was a lot of thought put into this and came to the conclusion that at this point in time, it's safe. So there's lots of logic, and it's obviously for all the kids.
Mm-hmm.
And with younger ones, I always recommend role plays, puppets, right? So present this situation in a way that the younger kids can understand, and then monitor your emotions. How do I feel? Model it to the kids. So how do you feel about it? Let's be open about it. Let's have this conversation. And let's just feel free to express what I feel, what you feel, what we're going to do about it.
I think that's a really interesting point when we think about how we're feeling about it. I mean, that's certainly not about, you know, how I feel about it. It has to be the way my child feels about it. But understanding that it's completely okay and normal to not have the same reaction to this news. And I say that amongst friendship groups as well. You know, there's no correct way to respond to this. Everyone's got their own lens, their own experience, their own vulnerabilities or celebrations, you know, around this. And it's not a one size fits all. We were speaking earlier in the week to teacher and teen coach Kieran McBreen, and he was explaining he's got a number of children at his school who are feeling very anxious about removing the mask because it, for them, is a physical barrier. For, you know, some it was about covering acne, for some it was fear of COVID. And I wondered if you had any advice for parents who can help talk to their children about anxiety, in particular about no masks.
Of course, you know, anxiety, usually we need to understand a little bit of what anxiety is, right? So it's the fear of dealing with the unknown. We don't know what's going to happen. It's lots of fears. It's also about a loss of power. Mm-hmm. Something happens to me. I have no choice. I cannot control the situation. It's lack of understanding sometimes, or knowledge, irrational fears. What if the worst case scenario comes to mind? So when we help children deal with anxiety, we need to address these factors. So the unknown, for example, yeah, we speak about it. We open up a conversation. Why do you think it's happening now? And what does it mean to us, to our family, to you, to me? With the loss of power, I believe we need to give children a choice when they want to remove mask, how fast they want to remove it. And I think it's very important that teachers also in school settings model that it's okay to wear a mask. And the mask is not only to prevent us from catching COVID, but it's, you know, if I have a flu, it's just a decent measure to protect others, right? So it's normalizing that.
I've been, I guess, kind of pleasantly surprised just how much agency some of the kids I've seen in my daughter's school, so primary age, some kids choosing to keep wearing a mask, and some teachers as well. And I think it just comes back to that individual choice. I mean, what I really don't want to happen is this becomes, you know, a point for bullying or, you know, any kind of derogatory chat about you're wearing a mask, this means X, Y, Z. And as you say, I think that a lot of that is going to come from the school, that, you know, this is a choice. Yeah. It's an option. You make your own decision based on your own circumstances. Dr. Ola, for anyone who's perhaps worried about anxiety levels creeping up in their teen and child, what's the best way of getting in touch with you and exploring some of the options? You know, play therapy, I mentioned CBT there as well.
I'm actually at the moment at Wellness Hub.
Fantastic.
So, I mean, the information is available online. So,
thank you so much. Really do appreciate it. And stay safe, stay healthy. And we'll talk to you soon. Dr. Ola there from Wellness Hub.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Turning our attentions to the age group of 16 to 25, looking to get out into the real world, get some real world experience, build up that resume, make some connections.
But how? Maybe our next guest can help. Sana Chayak is the co-founder of a new startup called Wing Studio. It's on a mission to help younger people enter the workforce, get some relevant experience on their resume, and maybe answer some questions about what it is they want to do. Sana, thank you for being with us. What gave you this idea? What do you think was missing, I guess, from the offering for that age group?
Hi, everyone. Thank you for having me here.
You're so welcome.
If we think about it, when we think about young adults who are starting their careers, they are always requested to have experience. But how do you
get it?
How do you get experience if you don't work? When we talked to employers, basically what they are referring to, it's not the experience, but reducing the risk of hiring someone who has the potential to do the job. Mm-hmm. So how can we demonstrate that this person has a potential? And with a CV, you cannot see this. You don't have evidence, you don't have credibility, and you cannot really see even the small things that a youngster is doing. We might underestimate the value of extracurricular activities, hobbies, and we wanted to highlight the skills that the young people are learning through their hobbies, volunteering experiences, activities, so that they can start their career.
So how do you do it? What does it look like and how does it play out in practice, Sana?
So it's an app or a platform also on the web where young people can go and build their profile based on their activities. Let's say the way you do it on social media, every day you achieve something, you do something, or if you have a hobby, let's say gaming. We always think about gaming as, oh, it's a waste of time. But if you look to it, it develops a lot of skills. It develops problem solving, leadership, strategy, decision taking. Mm-hmm. So if we have our young adults who are having hobbies, we help them reflect on what they learned out of this.
That must be a big confidence boost for them as well, to go, actually, you know, my parents might think I'm wasting time, but actually these are the attributes I'm bringing to it. It's funny you should mention about positives of gaming. There was a headline just earlier this week saying doctor surgeons who played video games for more than 3 hours a week made 37% fewer errors on the operating table.
Oh, wow.
So we're thinking about kind of motor skills, decision making. I don't know. That's an interesting example that you chose there. So hobbies, but also I guess volunteering? Are there ways of kind of highlighting things like that?
Definitely. Volunteering is a very important part of building the personality, the attributes and the skills for any young person or any candidate, because it develops also the consciousness about what's happening in the world, trying to make an impact. So that's important. But also we do this in addition to the academic also preparation, degrees. If they have also work experience, they can highlight it there. Because we look to a profile as a more complete aspect of who you are, not only what you worked and what you studied. Mm-hmm. It's also your other transferable skills. And there is a very big shift towards hiring based on transferable skills, because this is the potential and this is what stays with the person from one job to another, from one industry to another.
And that's a different way of working now than, you know, when I went to university, which was, you know, my friend Beth's going to go to university to be a lawyer. And now she's a lawyer and she'll probably be a lawyer until she retires. Whereas now that transferable skills, be it, you know, creativity or coding, leadership, being able to work across that kind of gig economy, which is still something a lot of people kind of trying to get their heads around, but it's trying to find companies that align with values, with a person. And how then does it work with connecting job seekers with universities or workplaces? How receptive are they to this platform?
We have an amazing positive traction from the different stakeholders in the ecosystem. And what we call ecosystem is all the education institutions, be it universities or high schools, colleges, etc., but also vocational or training and organizations, NGOs, youth organizations. And they're loving it because they say, we really want to improve the employability of our students. Mm-hmm. And how do we improve this employability and close the gap between what the employment industry is looking for versus the students that we train and we are getting out there in the market. So transferable skills are a big topic now. And as you said, the gig economy is really growing, and we see a lot of young people, even if they go for a corporate job, they still want to do some content creation or some freelancing. And that's great. I mean, I'm really happy to see this happening in this new era. With the new generation.
It is a new era. And I'm curious, you know, looking at some of the young people you're connecting with, what are some of the jobs or industries that they're keen to explore, Sarah? And where do you think the trends are, I guess?
That's a very interesting question. Well, we see, let's take UAE. Like, it's really advanced, and we see a lot of conferences about the metaverse and about what's happening in the tech industry, the biotech, etc. I think there is a trend towards these new careers, and we will see jobs that we never heard about in the metaverse. 100%
jobs that are probably going to make my head fall off. That's a job? Where in the metaverse are you doing this? But that's, you know, that's really exciting that you are able to connect them. And I know you've got the Youth Advisory Board as well, where you're speaking to people in exactly this age group, you know, 16 to 25. What are some of the concerns they have about being in the workforce or being young people in the world right now? What are you hearing?
Yeah, so from our Youth Advisory Council, we get all the insights to understand their challenges, and we also try to understand what they are looking for to improve the situation. So the first topic is finding a job without experience. A lot of companies, we even have some memes about having 30 years of experience while you are still 22, just graduated, etc. That's one big challenge. Another challenge is for them is, how do you identify which career to take? How do you identify the skills that you need for that specific career? Mm-hmm. For them, it's still quite abstract. As much as they can understand the practical skills, like if I'm a marketeer or I'm a coder, or it's clear. But transferable skills are still a bit blurry in their mind. What does it? How can I demonstrate and prove that I'm a team worker, or I'm good with adaptability, or that I'm a leader? Mm-hmm. These are very abstract concepts. And the fact that we are linking them to their hobbies or their activities, this is really helping them to understand and making them more concrete. And now we are working on the AI part, where the AI will be also suggesting the skills based on the post that they are doing. So if they're posting about a beach cleanup, let's say, the AI will be able to tell them the skills like leadership or sustainability or all the skills that they would have developed through this activity.
Wow. It's a whole new world. It takes me back to me, you know, working on my very first CV in Word, New Times Roman 14, in a nice cover letter. It sounds like things are, you know, changing at a great pace, and as they should for a whole new generation. For parents or indeed young people who are looking to find out more, what's the best way of getting in touch with you and checking out that platform?
So it's www.wing.studio. That's it, without a .com. It's wing.studio. And the app is available for iOS and Android.
Thank you so much for your time, Sana. Really interesting to hear a little bit more. If you do want details of the website, I'd be happy to connect you. All the very best. Keep us posted.
Thank you.
And I think it's really interesting to think about a generation who are graduating out of the pandemic to some obstacles, but I think some amazing opportunities as well. Really do appreciate your time.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Talking social media, taking your questions and perhaps your concerns as well, because as parents, we all have our worries when it comes to monitoring what our kids watch, who they're interacting with. And let's face it, no one has control 24 hours a day. So we do need to know that they are being protected in some way by those responsible, the social media giants. And recently, Instagram introduced some new parents' supervision tools. To find out more about this, joined now by Nadia Diabgaceras, the head of Instagram public policy for the MENA region. Nadia, how are you?
Hi, good afternoon, Helen. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. This is a topic I find quite emotionally complicated, to be completely honest, because I really enjoy social media. I love Instagram. I love the community that I've, you know, found through it. I love looking at all sorts, recipes, homes, holidays, having a bit of a nose at people's lives. But there is an underbelly to it all. And I think a lot of the concerns are coming through about children, teens using it and unfortunately not being protected to the level that many of us parents would like. And I just wondered, why have you decided to introduce some of these tools now?
Surely. First off, I want to say that I'm very excited to be here with you today. I'm also a big fan of your stories and your reels.
Oh, thank you.
And I would like to, I do, because I think they do represent very well what we have as working women here in Dubai with families. And I would also like to thank Dubai Eye for having me today. So just a bit of introduction to the listeners. My team is responsible for public policy. I'm based out of Dubai. And what we do is that we work very closely with experts and community organizations, but also parents' associations, teens themselves, and local authorities. And we get their feedback on our app and think together how Instagram can better support the communities, mm-hmm. particularly in our case, in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. So at Instagram, our biggest priority is really to ensure the safety and the well-being of our communities, particularly our younger audiences who are the teens. So we do share that concern and that care for teenagers on the platform. And over the last few years, we have been working very hard to design what we call age-appropriate experiences. And that means how can we make the app most appropriate for teens? And one of the elements of that holistic work is the parental supervision, which we are launching now in Nina as well. So let me share a little bit more about it. The parental supervision has been created to provide parents, caregivers, and also teenagers tools so that they can together decide what is right for the online experience mm-hmm. of the teen. These tools are very easy to use, and I'm happy to go into them in detail a bit later.
Definitely.
And we wanted to address the key concerns that we hear from parents. One, time spent online.
That's not just parents. That's me. I've had to put a limit, so I get a notification when I've spent a certain amount of time. I will admit, though, Nadia, I do just dismiss it.
Yeah, I know. This is also why on the parental supervision, we have also given parents the ability to control the ability to dismiss that. But so in addition to time spent, we also know that parents worry about the company of their kids online, so who their kids follow, who mm-hmm. follow their kids. And also a very key tricky question is how to have that conversation at home about online experience for teens, because we know that sometimes it's very tricky how to open the subject. And I don't have teenage kids, but I see it from my surroundings that they sometimes don't want to have that conversation.
Of course not. So, I mean, any conversation with my parents, whether it was, oh my goodness, you know, birds and bees or, you know, anything. If your parent sits you down and says, can you come, you know, we want to talk to you about something. Any teenager exactly. is going to go, this does not sound fun. I don't want to do exactly. that. Thanks very much. So I think that's actually really key, is trying to find ways to have a much needed conversation, because as parents, we're trying to navigate a digital space that we didn't navigate at that age. You know, this generation have never known not having the internet, whereas, you know, I don't know how old you are, Nadia, but I remember the dial-up tone very vividly, you know, in my teen years. So how do you then equip parents with the knowledge that they need to not sound like they're completely out of touch when talking about this platform and the very real issues with kids? Because surely knowledge is power in this situation.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is something that we've had in mind from the beginning. We needed to create an experience that was easy enough for parents to understand, but also acceptable for teens. And so we have gone through various rounds of conversation and consultations with parents themselves, with teenagers as well, but also with experts. What are the, to just come to a design that is acceptable for parents, acceptable for teens, and importantly, easy to use. Of course, we also understand that in a 5-minute conversation, sometimes it's not enough. And so we've also developed guides that explain very clearly to parents, not only how to use the tools, but also how to talk about them. What are conversation openers that they can use for their kids? And we've developed this with experts from around the world. So we also take into consideration the cultural nuances that in different places, starting conversations might be going in different directions. But if you would allow me to dive quickly on the actual tools, you will see that they are actually really easy to use. So the first step for the parental supervision to be enabled is for either the parent or the teenager to initiate that connection. And that's very easy. Go to the settings, and then there is a tab that is set in the Instagram app, and there is a tab that says supervision. And from there,
either the parent or the kid can send an invitation to the other part, so the parent or the kid, to initiate that connection. Once the connection is done, this connection allows the parent to have access to four key things that we know would put their mind at ease and will help with these conversation openers. The first one is setting time limits. The parent is able to see how long their teen is spending on Instagram each day and also set the amount of time that they think is appropriate. The reason why we haven't put a specific number of minutes, it's because it will really depend on totally. What the kid uses it for. So if a kid is using it to do the homework with their friends or watch inspiring videos of their favorite sports to become better, that is very different than if they spend the time mostly to scroll on feed. Mm-hmm. And so that conversation would allow parents and kids to decide what is the appropriate time. And then parents can also set a break. Parents can decide that between 7 p.m. at night and 8 a.m. in the morning, there is no Instagram. Or a specific time in the afternoon when they're doing their homework, there is no Instagram. In addition to this, the parents can also see who their teen follows and who follows them. And this gives them a very good idea of with whom they are interacting. And then in addition of all of this, when the teen reports content or blocks someone, they can also share this information with the parent. So then the parents can ask them, you know, why did you report this? Why did you block this person? Is there being mean with you, et cetera? So it really, for us, we know no one knows better what is best for their kids than their parents. And so what we wanted is to give this tool that helped that conversation, because what we've learned with experts and other teens is that they're actually quite comfortable talking about their experience online, but when they're asked, no one is imposed on them.
I think that's an interesting point about being, I guess, a bit of a contract in the family about these are our expectations and let's decide this together. You know, I'm not going to impose this upon you, but what, you know, what is workable? Where can we compromise on this?
Family Matters
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
And talking teens now, especially relating to social media, in conversation now with the head of Instagram's public policy for the MENA region, Nadia, joining us to explain some of the tools that they've recently introduced and, of course, to answer your questions as well. Nadia, I have a question which relates to bullying, to be honest. And I think no one is impervious to cruelty on Instagram, whether it is comments or DMs or who knows. But teens are particularly vulnerable. It's a very difficult stage of life. And I just wondered what's being done, whether it's behind the scenes or anything we might not be aware of to protect our children, for want of a better phrase, from bullying, whether it's people they know or strangers on the platform.
Absolutely. Instagram, we are really committed to protecting teens on the platform. And very sadly, while bullying is something that existed prior to social media, with the expansion of social media use, bullying unfortunately also came online. So this is something that we've been working on since the inception of Instagram. And we understand and know and feel how incredibly important this work is. And so we're constantly innovating and improving and finding new ways to protect young people. First, our rules are really clear. We do not allow content that either bullies, insults, or harasses another person. And our rules are actually even more stringent if the victim is a minor, although we know that this affects everyone. So for all people, we have very stringent rules. Now, what makes bullying very special is that sometimes it's not about an insult, it's about the tone, mm-hmm. it's about the context. And so in addition to the rules, we also know that it's important to give people the ability to manage the experience online, because something that it might be a joke, I just don't want to see it on my comments. And I don't want other people to see that I'm called that in my comments. So we have developed a series of tools that are available on the settings as well. I always mention that. Go to the settings and please explore there, because there are plenty of tools to use. And then I can decide, for example, that I don't want to be tagged or mentioned. So I can control if I want everyone and only the people I follow or no one at all to mention me on my story, which is particularly, I think, also relevant for people who are highly followed, like, for example, like in your case. We also have hidden words, which is like a comment filter where you can hide any comment or any word that is inappropriate or might be offensive. And you can also create your own words that you don't want to see in your own comments or in the comments from other people that you see. And we all work very hard. We work very closely with experts, because we know that some of these complex issues, there's not a one-size-fits-all. Mm-hmm. The one that I always like to comment on is restrict. We all know what is block, in which the person knows that you're blocking them. But what we hear from young people is that if the bully knows that the victim is blocking them, it will trigger more aggressivity in the school. So what Restrict does, for example, is that it acts like a block. The bully doesn't know. So only the bully sees their comments. If the bully is commenting on my post, only they see them, but neither I nor anyone else would see those comments. And we know that in a lot of cases, the bully is doing so to get feedback, to get attention. And so when that person feels completely ignored, they stop. So this is just one example of the methods that we have. Also with Restrict, if the bully is in a thread where I am about to enter a DM, I will know, so I decide not to. Because we do know that it's so contextual that the best way for us to help the community is to give them agency, to give them all the tools to decide how they can tailor the experience online so it can be a joyful experience on Instagram.
Nadia, can I ask you about content that's deemed dangerous, you know, such as pro-eating disorders or self-harm? You know, the minute in the UK press, we're seeing an inquest right now into the death of a 17-year-old, Molly Russell, who took her own life after viewing material that had been deemed to have the potential to cause great harm. What can we do about protecting our teens from content that we really desperately don't want them to see? Or is there really no way around that?
No, absolutely. So on eating disorders and with self-harm content, we have a distinct rules. We do not allow any content that either promotes or provides advice on how to go about this. However, we do allow people to talk about their experience with eating disorders or self-harm. The reason for this is that when we have talked with psychiatrists, they've told us actually that it's important to leave that content up because maybe that's the way of the teenager to ask for help. Mm-hmm. And so we have a very nuanced approach towards this type of content because we absolutely don't want to have any content that is promoting. And on the other side, we do understand that it might be a call for help. Mm-hmm. And so we are very careful with what we allow and what we don't allow. Of course, we do not recommend this content. Like, even content that is talking about an experience will be harder to find for the general public because we believe that the content should remain on the platform and that person can ask for help. It is important that people are not directly exposed to these content.
I think that's a really important distinction because I think for an awful lot of people, you know, social media is a real lifeline. You know, it gets an awful lot of bad rap for many reasons, but for lots of users, it can be a place of finding a community, finding a tribe, finding support. So making that distinction between, I guess, promoting certain, you know, behaviours or habits and educating and giving someone a voice, you know, a platform to share their experience and hopefully help other people. It's very, very nuanced. I just want to quickly go to the text line. Sana's saying, my daughter is 13, loves IG. Not for chatting, she watches videos, how to bake, makeup, funny videos. However, I do check what she's doing and I read her messages. I know that's an invasion of privacy, but these days you just have to. She gets annoyed, but I also think she understands the dangers of it. And the message here, no name, saying, my son is just 13 and is begging for Instagram like his friends. I've always been very anti-social media for the kids. I have Instagram myself, but rarely use it. I'm considering allowing it with the agreement I have as password. Does that sound okay? So you were talking earlier about some of the tools that are at a parent's disposal. Do you recommend kind of sharing passwords and people looking at their kids' messages? To my mind, I'm like, yeah, if that's your boundaries, your guidelines as a parent, everybody's different though, right?
Like, I think it's exactly as you said it before. It's really a contract within the family. If that is a model that works for the family, that is absolutely their right to do so. From a parental supervision, we do not allow the showing of DMs from the teen to the parent because we have been following the guidance from the UN on the rights of the child, which include the right to privacy. And so what we want is to open the conversation between the parents and the teen. And if the agreement is between them is that actually the teen is comfortable and the parent is more comfortable with the teen spending time online if they see their DM, absolutely. I think it is just a decision for the families to make. The reason what we are launching parental supervision is precisely that, is that we want to help having that open conversation so parents feel more comfortable when their teens are turning 13, which is the minimum age to be on Instagram. And, you know, digital life will always be with us. I think earlier that we we help our children understand and have a healthy relationship with social media, then the healthier adults they will be in their online life.
And lastly, Nadia, what kind of, I guess, focus groups or surveys are being conducted by Meta to investigate the impact of social media on the mental health of young people? And what do you anticipate that leading to in the future in terms of the way we navigate that platform?
So we're always conducting consultations with young people. Like, for example, here in the Middle East, we conducted a well-being co-design with the Arab Youth Center, where we brought young people and then asked them directly what type of changes in the app would help or will change your experience for the better or the worse. So we're constantly asking feedback, because that's the way where we iterate and we improve our services. So this is something that we do constantly, and we are focusing a lot on age-appropriate design, because we do think that we have to find an important balance for young people, giving them space so they can explore Instagram, and at the same within like a safeguarded experience where both them and their parents feel comfortable.
Thank you, Nadia. Really do appreciate it. And as you say, explore the settings, educate yourself. We can't talk to our kids about a platform that we know nothing about. And it is unfortunately in those gaps of knowledge where, you know, things happen. So we've got a responsibility as parents to be adopting platforms and, you know, getting down with the kids. Nadia, really do appreciate your time. Thank you so, so much. Nadia Diab-Kassara speaking to us as the head of Instagram's public policy in the MENA region.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Talking sustainability now, and I think we've got an awful lot to learn from the new generation. In fact, Poonam's 16-year-old niece said to her recently that she doesn't want to buy new clothes anymore, would rather go to charity shops, swaps. And when she was asked why, it's because thinking about the planet. My children are far better versed than I am. And I think a lot of this is coming from schools. So many concerns from this next generation, things that perhaps we didn't even think about. And it is all for them. Sustainability is a world issue. And Arma Sheikh from PepsiCo Middle East has just collaborated with Dubai Can to educate more kids and schools about this topic. Arma, thank you for joining us today. Tell us a little bit about this kind of natural collaboration. Where did it begin and what was the initial aim?
Thank you, Helen, and delighted to be here. You know, it's as we were getting ready for the Expo 2020, which was at this time last year, we got a call from Dubai Ministry of Economy and Tourism and say, hey, we want to chat to you about Dubai Can initiative. And would you be interested? So we got on a call. It was very interesting because we were thinking about launching fun but sustainable innovation to Dubai Expo.
Perfect place for it as well.
Absolutely.
Can I just say, I really miss Expo.
We can still go back, I think, starting October.
I know.
So what we did was, with Dubai Expo, we launched still water in a can. As you know, can is a sustainable packaging solution. And then we also brought in about 30 Aquafina water station that allowed people to get in water still sparkling, flavored, cold, you know, super cold, intense flavors, so you can get the water you like. And they were such a big hit that we were getting queues really out the door, around the corner. People were bringing their refillable bottles to fill up, and we had to very quickly scale up and get them into all parts of Expo. Mm-hmm. So when we heard the Dubai Can initiative, it was almost like the UAE government was in our, you know, innovation room thinking about something similar. It's a very natural partnership. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And now we've got stations all over Dubai. I went to the one on Kite Beach just at the weekend. And I know this sounds like a ridiculous thing to say. Now, I must say my dad worked in desalination and water for a very long time. And whenever we used to go on holiday as kids, he'd buy the local water and bring back the bottles. This is a long way of saying my dad's a real water nerd. Okay. And he's definitely passed that on to me. The Dubai Can water is delicious. And it sounds like such a weird thing to say, but when you've lived in a region where you're drinking bottled water a lot, you do start to notice the difference. So the station's all over Dubai now. And I think it's really wonderful to hear actually about how well that was received at Expo Dubai, because that's what we want to be encouraging. You know, people bringing in their water bottles, people thinking about how am I going to spend the day? How am I going to stay hydrated? And now this natural progression to all over Dubai. So tell us a bit about the children. Why are you choosing to focus on this age group, Arma?
You know, you talked about Poonam's niece. I mean, my own kids, my own, you know, the family, you know, the children in our family are no different. I put it down to, you know, back when we were 16 or 18 year olds, we were focused on university, job, earning,
boys,
making a living. Well, not in my case.
My mum will definitely say, you might say you were talking about studying, Helen, but it was more socializing. Yeah. But I wasn't thinking about the planet.
But I think the generation today, they've seen us and they've seen us how our generation has behaved. Mm-hmm. And I think they want to do something different. Mm-hmm. And I think full power to them. There's so much we can learn from them. And, you know, I can tell you the few ways that we're trying to engage them. But to me, to all the moms and dads out there, there's nothing like being a good role model to them, right? So you start off with that and say, how sustainable are our own practices are? So what are we buying? Is it recyclable? Are we actually recycling it? How are we conserving water? I mean, the great debate about showers versus baths, you should have them in your own house. Mm-hmm. And you make sure, I watch our water usage in our house like a hawk.
Do you?
I turn off all the lights. And you see, because if I'm not doing that, the kids are going to pick on the dad being the one who's not doing it.
My kids are the ones there. They're like, mum, you've left the tap running when you're brushing your teeth. And
there
I think
you go.
I think
yeah.
there's actually a lot to be said for them being the role models as well. I think that's a huge boost of confidence for them to come home from school or to read a book or a magazine and say, did you know? And for them to really own it.
True.
I was just saying to you off air, my daughter did a module on saving the orangutans and they're talking about palm oil, and now we cannot go around Spinneys without her saying, this is okay to buy, or, you know, we're not going to go and eat there. And she's really passionate about it because she feels like she's teaching me something. So what are you doing in schools and what's that actually looking like?
Yeah, so we're partnering with schools here and elsewhere in the Middle East as well. So first I would call out the Orenda Tribe. It's a grassroots organization that is actually bringing the art of the power of art and storytelling to influence kids. So we worked with them in developing what we call Impact Box. If you go to their website, you can sort of play around with it. There's a digital game, the life of a plastic bottle in terms of how you sort it, how you recycle it, and how it turns into alternative uses. So you're trying to teach the kids the impact recycling can have and sustainable solution can have on this planet. We also just did a recent MOU with Prince Sultan University in Saudi Arabia, where we're essentially asking the students to use their R&D brain power facility to help us find better solutions. And we'll bring PepsiCo know-how to the university. In return, they're bringing sort of their research and their
creativity.
Projects to us.
Tell us a little bit about the Greenhouse Accelerator Program. What was it all about and where are you hoping it's going to go in the future?
It starts off with the premise that we don't have all the answers. And I think together we can solve some really powerful challenges that we're having through collaboration. How do we do that? We invited the startup. We thought, let's tap into the ecosystem that the startup community has in the Middle East. So we received 70 applications from all over the Middle East, Saudi, Jordan, Lebanon, and UAE. We received, of the 70, we selected 10. And they are now part of this Greenhouse Accelerator program. They've each been given $20,000 as essentially seed money to develop their idea and through PepsiCo mentoring, coaching, develop into a powerful solution that hopefully we can incorporate and we can learn, bring it into our toolbox. And next week, we're going to announce the winner of those 10.
If the finalists are getting 20 grand, what's the winner getting?
$100,000.
Wow.
And the chance to work with PepsiCo. And I tell you, the biggest thing for startups is that they've had access to PepsiCo know-how, PepsiCo coaches and mentors, as well as they're getting some good exposure in terms of the real-world solution that they're going after.
I know you can't announce the winner, but I'm curious if you could give us a bit of a read on some of the ideas or the areas of concern that some of these startups are addressing.
You're right, I can't talk about the winners, but I will talk about one example. And by no means this example people should not read into anything. So we have one of the startups is called Nadira. They have a project in Lebanon called Yalla Return. Essentially, it's trash for cash. They're asking people to bring in from their homes whatever is recyclable. And they have a sorting facility where they can, plastic, cans, anything, in terms of phones, batteries, they're able to recycle.
E-waste, I think, is still something that we're I'm personally not taking particularly seriously, and I know we really should when we look at landfill and what's going in there.
Absolutely. E-waste is you know, printer cartridges, and you can go on. Now, what they do is you can actually, when you bring those recyclable items from your home and you deposit with them, they will give you a voucher that you can go into the nearest hypermarket and redeem it for your food basket.
Hey.
You know, so it's in a way, in today's commodity inflationary environment, they're essentially helping people to turn some of their cash into trash.
So incentivizing goodness. But I think, and honestly, a lot of us want to do better. Sometimes you just don't know how. And I think it's really important that companies such as yourself are working with startups to really signpost how we can do it. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank
really,
you,
it's really interesting to hear what's been happening behind the scenes. And will you please, the winner's being announced on October 6th. So maybe you can connect us and we can find out a little bit more about what they have done to win that money, that accolade, and all of the exposure as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Amma Sheikh speaking to us, the CEO of PepsiCo Middle East. And thank you for downloading this episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. Don't forget, you can subscribe. You'll get direct to your phone as soon as it's out. And you can listen to me live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Monday to Friday between 2 and 5 p.m.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.